To follow the analogy of the thief who is going through another man's billfold, Constant ripped open the seams of his memory, hoping to find a secret compartment with something of value in it. There was no secret compartment, nothing of value. All that remained to Constant were the husks of his memory, unstitched, flaccid flaps. The ancient butler looked adoringly at Rumford and went through the cringing contortions of an ugly old woman posing for a painting of the Madonna.
"The master," he bleated. "The young master."
"I can read your mind, you know," said Rumford.
"Can you?" said Constant humbly.
"Easiest thing in the world," said Rumford.
His eyes twinkled.
"You're not a bad sort, you know," he said, "particularly when you forget who you are."
He touched Constant lightly on the arm. It was a politician's gesture, a vulgar public gesture, by a man who in private among his own kind would take wincing pains never to touch anyone.
"If it's really so important to you, at this stage of our relationship, to feel superior to me in some way," he said to Constant pleasantly, "think of this. You can reproduce, and I cannot."
He now turned his broad back to Constant, led the way through a series of very grand chambers. He paused in one, insisted that Constant admire a huge oil painting of a little girl holding the reins of a pure white pony. The little girl wore a white bonnet, a white starched dress, white gloves, white socks, and white shoes. She was the cleanest, most frozen little girl that Malachi Constant had ever seen. There was a strange expression on her face, and Constant decided that she was worried about getting the least bit dirty.
"Nice picture," said Constant.
"Wouldn't it be too bad if she fell into a mud puddle?" said Rumford.
Constant smiled uncertainly.
"My wife as a child,"
said Rumford abruptly, and led the way out of the room. He led the way down a back corridor and into a tiny room hardly larger than a big broom closet. It was 10 feet long, 6 feet wide, and had a ceiling, like the rest of the rooms in the mansion, 20 feet high. The room was like a chimney. There were 2 wing chairs in it.
"An architectural accident," said Rumford, closing the door and looking up at the ceiling.
"Pardon me?" said Constant.
"This room," said Rumford.
With a limp right hand, he made the magical sign for spiral staircase.
"It was one of the few things in life I ever really wanted with all my heart when I was a boy. This little room."
He nodded at the shelves that ran 6 feet up the window wall. The shelves were beautifully made. Over the shelves was a driftwood plank that had written on it, in blue paint, "Skip's Museum." Skip's Museum was a museum of mortal remains, of endoskeletons and exoskeletons, of shells, coral, bone, cartilage, and chitin, of dottles and orts and residua of souls long gone. Most of the specimens were those that a child, presumably Skip, could find easily on the beaches and in the woods of Newport. Some were obviously expensive presents to a child extraordinarily interested in the science of biology. Chief among these presents was the complete skeleton of an adult human male. There was also the empty suit of armor of an armadillo, a stuffed dodo, and the long spiral tusk of a narwhal, playfully labeled by Skip, "Unicorn Horn."
"Who is Skip?" said Constant.
"I am Skip," said Rumford. "Was?"
"I didn't know," said Constant.
"Just in the family, of course," said Rumford.
Said Constant.
Rumford sat down in one of the wing chairs, motioned Constant to the other.
"Angels can't either, you know," said Rumford.
"Can't what?" said Constant.
"Reproduce," said Rumford.
He offered Constant a cigarette, took one for himself, and placed it in a long bone cigarette holder.
I'm sorry my wife was too indisposed to come downstairs to meet you, he said. It isn't you she's avoiding. It's me.
You, said Constant.
That's correct, said Rumford. She hasn't seen me since my first materialization, he chuckled ruefully. Once was enough.
I'm sorry, said Constant. I don't understand.
She didn't like my fortune-telling, said Rumford. She found it very upsetting, what little I told her about her future. She doesn't care to hear more.
He sat back in his wing chair, inhaled deeply.
I tell you, Mr. Constant, he said genially, it's a thankless job, telling people it's a hard, hard universe they're in.
She said you told her to invite me, said Constant.
She got the message from the butler, said Rumford. I dared her to invite you, or she wouldn't have done it. You might keep that in mind. The only way to get her to do anything is to tell her she hasn't got the courage to do it. Of course, it isn't an infallible technique. I could send her a message now, telling her that she doesn't have the courage to face the future, and she would send me back a message saying I was right.
You really can see into the future? Said Constant. The skin of his face tightened, felt parched. His palms perspired.
In a punctual way of speaking, yes, said Rumford. When I ran my spaceship into the chronosynclastic infundibulum, it came to me in a flash that everything that ever has been always will be, and everything that ever will be always has been.
He chuckled again.
Knowing that rather takes the glamour out of fortune-telling. Makes it the simplest, most obvious thing imaginable.
You told your wife everything that was going to happen to her?
Said Constant. This was a glancing question. Constant had no interest in what was going to happen to Rumford's wife. He was ravenous for news of himself. In asking about Rumford's wife, he was being coy.
Well, not everything, said Rumford. She wouldn't let me tell her everything. What little I did tell her quite spoiled her appetite for more.
I see, said Constant, not seeing at all.
Yes, said Rumford genially. I told her that you and she were to be married on Mars.
He shrugged.
Not married, exactly, he said, but bred by the Martians, like farm animals.
Winston Niles Rumford was a member of the one true American class. The class was a true one because its limits had been clearly defined for at least two centuries. Clearly defined for anyone with an eye for definitions. From Rumford's small class had come a tenth of America's presidents, a quarter of its explorers, a third of its eastern seaboard governors, a half of its full-time ornithologists, three-quarters of its great yachtsmen, and virtually all of its underwriters of the deficits of grand opera. It was a class singularly free of quacks, with the notable exception of political quacks. The political quackery was a means of gaining office, and was never carried into private life. Once in office, members of the class became, almost without exception, magnificently responsible. If Rumford accused the Martians of breeding people as though people were no better than farm animals, he was accusing the Martians of doing no more than his own class had done. The strength of his class depended to some extent on sound money management, but depended to a much larger extent on marriages based cynically on the sorts of children likely to be produced. Healthy, charming, wise children were the desiderata. The most competent, if humorless, analysis of Rumford's class is, beyond question, Waltham Kitteridge's The American Philosopher Kings. It was Kitteridge who proved that the class was, in fact, a family, with its loose ends neatly turned back into a hard core of consanguinity, through the agency of cousin marriages. Rumford and his wife, for instance, were third cousins and detested each other. And when Rumford's class was diagrammed by Kitteridge, it resembled nothing so much as the hard, ball-like knot known as a monkey's fist. Waltham Kitteridge often floundered in his The American Philosopher Kings, trying to translate the atmosphere of Rumford's class into words. Like the college professor he was, Kitteridge groped only for big words, and, finding no apt ones, he coined a lot of untranslatable new ones. Of all Kitteridge's jargon, only one term has ever found its way into conversation. The term is unneurotic courage. It was that sort of courage, of course, that carried Winston Niles Rumford out into space. It was pure courage, not only pure of lusts for fame and money, but pure of any drives that smack of the misfit or screwball. There are, incidentally, two strong common words that would have served handsomely, one or the other, in place of all of Kitteridge's jargon. The words are style and gallantry. When Rumford became the first person to own a private spaceship, paying $58 million out of his own pocket for it, that was style. When the governments of Earth suspended all space exploration because of the chronosynclastic infundibula, and Rumford announced that he was going to Mars, that was style. When Rumford announced that he was taking a perfectly tremendous dog along, as though a spaceship were nothing more than a sophisticated sports car, as though a trip to Mars were little more than a spin down the Connecticut Turnpike, that was style. When it was unknown what would happen if a spaceship went into a chronosynclastic infundibulum and Rumford steered a course straight for the middle of one, that was gallantry indeed. To contrast Malachi Constant of Hollywood with Winston Niles Rumford of Newport and Eternity, everything Rumford did, he did with style, making all mankind look good. Everything Constant did, he did in style, aggressively, loudly, childishly, wastefully, making himself and mankind look bad. Constant bristled with courage, but it was anything but unneurotic. Every courageous thing he had ever done had been motivated by spitefulness and by goads from childhood that made fear seem puny indeed. Constant, having just heard from Rumford that he was to be mated to Rumford's wife on Mars, looked away from Rumford to the Museum of Remains along one wall. Constant's hands were clasped together, tightening on each other pulsingly. Constant cleared his throat several times. Then he whistled thinly between his tongue and the roof of his mouth. In all, he was behaving like a man who was waiting for a terrible pain to pass. He closed his eyes and sucked in air between his teeth.
"Loo-dee-doo, Mr. Rumford," he said softly. He opened his eyes. "Mars?" he said.
"Mars," said Rumford. "Of course, that isn't your ultimate destination. Or Mercury, either."
"Mercury," said Constant.
He made an unbecoming quack of that lovely name.
"Your destination is Titan," said Rumford. "But you visit Mars, Mercury, and Earth again before you get there."
It is crucial to understand at what point in the history of punctual space exploration it was that Malachi Constant received the news of his prospective visits to Mars, Mercury, Earth, and Titan. The state of mind on Earth with regard to space exploration was much like the state of mind in Europe with regard to exploration of the Atlantic before Christopher Columbus set out. There were these important differences, however. The monsters between space explorers and their goals were not imaginary, but numerous, hideous, various, and uniformly cataclysmic. The cost of even a small expedition was enough to ruin most nations, and it was a virtual certainty that no expedition could increase the wealth of its sponsors. In short, on the basis of horse sense and the best scientific information, there was nothing good to be said for the exploration of space. The time was long past when one nation could seem more glorious than another by hurling some heavy object into nothingness. Galactic Spacecraft, a corporation controlled by Malachi Constant, had, as a matter of fact, received the very last order for such a showpiece. A rocket 300 feet high and 36 feet in diameter. It had actually been built, but the fire order had never come. The ship was called simply the Whale, and was fitted with living quarters for 5 passengers. What had brought everything to such an abrupt halt was the discovery of the chronosynclastic infundibula. They had been discovered mathematically on the basis of bizarre flight patterns of unmanned ships sent out, supposedly in advance of men. The discovery of the chronosynclastic infundibula said to mankind, in effect, "What makes you think you're going anywhere?" It was a situation made to order for American fundamentalist preachers. They were quicker than philosophers or historians or anybody to talk sense about the truncated age of space. 2 hours after the firing of the Whale was called off indefinitely, the Reverend Bobby Denton shouted at his love crusade in Wheeling, West Virginia. "And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore is the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of the earth." Bobby Denton spitted his audience on a bright and loving gaze and proceeded to roast it whole over the coals of its own iniquity. "Are these not Bible times?" he said. "Have we not builded of steel and pride an abomination far taller than the Tower of Babel of old? And did we not mean, like those builders of old, to get right into heaven with it? And haven't we heard it said many times that the language of scientists is international? They all use the same Latin and Greek words for things, and they all talk the language of numbers." This seemed a particularly damning piece of evidence to Denton, and the love crusaders agreed bleakly, without quite understanding why. "So why should we cry out in surprise and pain now, when God says to us what he said to the people who builded the Tower of Babel? No! Get away from there! You are not going to heaven or anywhere else with that thing! Scatter, you hear? Quit talking the language of science to each other! Nothing will be restrained from you which all you have imagined to do if you all keep talking the language of science to each other, and I don't want that! I, your Lord God on high, want things restrained from you, so you will quit thinking about crazy towers and rockets to heaven, and start thinking about how to be better neighbors and husbands and wives and daughters and sons. Don't look to rockets for salvation. Look to your homes and churches." Bobby Denton's voice grew hoarse and hushed. "You want to fly through space? God has already given you the most wonderful spaceship in all creation. Yes. Speed? You want speed? The spaceship God has given you goes 60,000 miles an hour, and will keep on running at that speed for all eternity, if God wills it. You want a spaceship that will carry men in comfort? You've got it. It won't carry just a rich man and his dog, or just 5 men or 10 men. No, God is no piker. He's given you a spaceship that will carry billions of men, women, and children. Yes, and they don't have to stay strapped in chairs or wear fish bowls over their heads. No, not on God's spaceship. The people on God's spaceship can go swimming, and walk in the sunshine, and play baseball, and go ice skating, and go for family rides in the family automobile on Sunday after church, and a family chicken dinner." Bobby Denton nodded. "Yes," he said. "And if anybody thinks his God is mean for putting things out in space to stop us from flying out there, just let him remember the spaceship God already gave us. And we don't have to buy the fuel for it, and worry and fret over what kind of fuel to use. No!
God worries about all that. God told us what we had to do on this wonderful spaceship. He wrote the rules so anybody could understand them. You don't have to be a physicist, or a great chemist, or an Albert Einstein to understand them. No! And he didn't make a whole lot of rules either. They tell me that if they were to fire the whale, they would have to make 11,000 separate checks before they could be sure it was ready to go. Is this valve open? Is that valve closed? Is that wire tight? Is that tank full? And on and on and on to 11,000 things to check. Here on God's spaceship, God only gives us 10 things to check, and not for any little trip to some big, dead, poisonous stones out in space, but for a trip to the kingdom of heaven. Think of it. Where would you rather be tomorrow? On Mars, or in the kingdom of heaven? You know what the checklist is on God's round, green spaceship? Do I have to tell you? You want to hear God's countdown? The Love Crusaders shouted back that they did. 10, said Bobby Denton. Do you covet thy neighbor's house, or his manservant, or his maidservant, or his ox, or his ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 9, said Bobby Denton. Do you bear false witness against thy neighbor? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 8, said Bobby Denton. Do you steal? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 7, said Bobby Denton. Do you commit adultery? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 6, said Bobby Denton. Do you kill? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 5, said Bobby Denton. Do you honor thy father and thy mother? Yes, cried the Love Crusaders. 4, said Bobby Denton. Do you remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy? Yes, cried the Love Crusaders. 3, said Bobby Denton. Do you take the name of the Lord thy God in vain? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 2, said Bobby Denton. Do you make any graven images? No, cried the Love Crusaders. 1, cried Bobby Denton. Do you put any gods before the one true Lord thy God? No, cried the Love Crusaders. Blast off, shouted Bobby Denton joyfully. Paradise, here we come. Blast off, children, and amen. Well, murmured Malachi Constant, there in the chimney-like room under the staircase in Newport. It looks like the messenger is finally going to be used.
What was that?
Said Rumford. My name, it means faithful messenger, said Constant. What's the message?
Sorry, said Rumford. I know nothing about any message.
He cocked his head quizzically.
Somebody said something to you about a message?
Constant turned his palms upward.
I mean, what am I going to all this trouble to get to Triton for?
Titan,
Rumford corrected him.
Titan, Triton, said Constant. What the blast would I go there for?
Blast was a weak, prissy, Eagle Scoutish word for Constant to use, and it took him a moment to realize why he had used it. Blast was what space cadets on television said when a meteorite carried away a control surface, or the navigator turned out to be a space pirate from the planet Zircon. He stood.
Why the hell should I go there?
You do, I promise you, said Rumford.
Constant went over to the window, some of his arrogant strength returning.
I tell you right now, he said, I'm not going.
Sorry to hear that, said Rumford.
I'm supposed to do something for you when I get there, said Constant.
No,
said Rumford.
Then why are you sorry, said Constant. What's it to you?
Nothing, said Rumford. I'm only sorry for you. You'll really be missing something.
Like what? Said Constant.
Well, the most pleasant climate imaginable, for one thing, said Rumford.
Climate? Said Constant contemptuously. With houses in Hollywood, the Vale of Kashmir, Acapulco, Manitoba, Tahiti, Paris, Bermuda, Rome, New York, and Cape Town, I should leave Earth in search of happier climes?
There's more to Titan than just climate, said Rumford. The women, for instance, are the most beautiful creatures between the sun and Betelgeuse.
Constant guffawed bitterly.
Women, he said. You think I'm having trouble getting beautiful women? You think I'm love-starved, and the only way I'll ever get close to a beautiful woman is to climb on a rocket ship and head for one of Saturn's moons? Are you kidding? I've had women so beautiful, anybody between the sun and Betelgeuse would sit down and cry if the women said as much as hello to him.
He took out his billfold and slipped from it a photograph of his most recent conquest. There was no question about it. The girl in the photograph was staggeringly beautiful. She was Miss Canal Zone, a runner-up in the Miss Universe contest. And, in fact, far more beautiful than the winner of the contest. Her beauty had frightened the judges. Constant handed Rumford the photograph.
They got anything like that on Titan? He said.
Rumford studied the photograph respectfully, handed it back.
No, he said. Nothing like that on Titan.
Okay, said Constant, feeling very much in control of his destiny again. Climate, beautiful women. What else?
Nothing else, said Rumford mildly.
He shrugged.
Oh, art objects, if you like art.
I've got the biggest private art collection in the world, said Constant.
Constant had inherited this famous art collection. The collection had been made by his father, or rather by agents of his father. It was scattered through museums all over the world, each piece plainly marked as part of the Constant collection. The collection had been made and then deployed in this manner on the recommendation of the Director of Public Relations of Magnum Opus Incorporated, the corporation whose sole purpose was to manage the Constant affairs. The purpose of the collection had been to prove how generous and useful